And now, America's number one show on pop culture and politics. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day, another great week, in fact, in this greatest nation on God's green earth. A great week when the campaigns for president are desperately competing to try to raise money. That includes the campaign being run by Robert F. Kennedy Jr. He doesn't have a party yet. He doesn't have a running mate yet. But it turns out that the rumors are now very heavy that his running mate is a billionaire. She got a billionaire in a contentious divorce against her former husband, Sergey Brin, one of the people who started Google. He apparently, at the time of their divorce, was worth $95 billion. That's with a B, dollars. She got a billion of it, and so now she's in a great position to help Robert F. Kennedy in his campaign. And more, that campaign looks like it's aimed at taking voters away from Trump more than taking voters away from Biden. We will get to that latest political news. And also the political news about no labels. How is no labels going to go about selecting their presidential candidate, especially when nobody seems to want to run for these people somewhere on the political fringe? And yes, I'm afraid it looks like that, because look, the choice is so clear. Trump gave a speech over the weekend that even by the standards of Trump rally speeches, this one was pretty extraordinary. I mean, pretty darn amazing. Meanwhile, they are reporting just minutes ago at the New York Times that Donald J. Trump's lawyers disclosed today that he had failed to secure a roughly $500 million bond. That's $500 million in his civil fraud case in New York. That raises the prospect that the state could seek to freeze some of his bank accounts and seize some of his marquee properties. The court filing, coming 1 week after the bond is due, suggested the former president might soon face a financial crisis unless an appeals court comes to his rescue. Mr. Trump has asked the appeals court to pause the $454 million judgment that the New York judge imposed on Mr. Trump in the fraud case last month, or he could accept a bond of only $100 million. Otherwise, the New York Attorney General's office, which brought the case, might soon move to collect from Mr. Trump. That's Letitia James, and yes, she is a Democratic partisan. The former president has been unable to secure the full bond, his lawyers said in the court filing today, calling it a practical impossibility despite diligent efforts. Those efforts included approaching about 30 companies that provide appeal bonds, and yet the lawyer said he has encountered insurmountable difficulties. Wow. The New York Times writes, this looming deadline could not come at a worse time for Mr. Trump. Just last week, he finalized a $91.6 million bond in the defamation case he recently lost to the writer E. Jean Carroll, a costly deal that drained him of precious cash. And this comes out at the time when the leading story in Hotline. And it really is. It's just unbelievable that we're at this point, at this stage in the campaign. President Biden's campaign, together with the Democratic National Committee and other allied committees, announced that they had cumulatively raised $53 million in February and that they had on hand a combined $155 million at the end of the month. In other words, March 1st, they had $155 million. Remember the number, please? Okay. And the presumptive GOP nominee, Donald J. Trump, and the Republican National Committee and other aligned committees had a combined $40 million on hand at the end of January and only announced a joint fundraising account last week. Okay, what this means is that it's pretty incredible that President Biden has about four times, 400% the amount of cash on hand to fund his campaign, which may not make up for his fumbles and stumbles, though he's pretty good at the correspondence dinner over the weekend. We'll play you some highlights and lowlights. But this is remarkable. And then the story from, again, New York Times, it says as many as three nights a week, Trump has been hosting private dinners at Mar-a-Lago, schmoozing with some of the Republican Party's biggest financiers as he races to address a sizable cash shortfall against Biden. And again, a sizable cash shortfall, yeah, getting one-fourth the amount of money on hand. Though Trump doesn't request money from these potential donors at these private dinners at Mar-a-Lago, his team and allied super PACs hope the charm offensive will eventually pay political and financial dividends. Tech billionaire Larry Ellison, who had planned to fund Senator Tim Scott's presidential campaign, and sugar mogul Pepe Fanjul, are among the attendees. I will admit I have never before heard of Pepe Fanjul. Trump painted a picture on Saturday of the United States in deep decline, overrun by migrants and criminals, on the verge of economic collapse and in grave danger if voters do not put him back in office in November. During his rally in Dayton, Ohio, Trump said, if I don't get elected, that's going to be a bloodbath in the whole country. That's going to be the least of it. It's going to be a bloodbath for the country. Trump reiterated his belief that undocumented immigrants are poisoning the blood of the country. That's in quotes during an interview with Fox News anchor Howard Kurtz yesterday, a comment that echoed fascist dictators. Trump said, quote, our country is being poisoned. Trump defended his searing rhetoric toward immigrants, arguing that it helps stir debate. The former president also hinted that he would soon publicly back a federal abortion restriction, and that would include any abortions on live children. No, I'm serious. This is part of what they are covering in the article. An abortion on a living child, and one who has already been delivered, that is not legal, not anywhere. And I don't even think that the most radical Democrats would take that position. And then a judge Friday also delayed former President Donald Trump's hush money criminal trial by 30 days to give his defense lawyers time to go through a large amount of recently obtained evidence from a previous federal investigation on the matter. Judge Juan Merchan agreed to a 30-day postponement and scheduled a March 25th hearing to address questions about the Justice Department evidence dump. The other big news, of course, right before the weekend, Mike Pence, the Vice President of the United States, who served loyally with President Trump for all 4 years of his administration, gave a statement directly to Fox News. No, he would not be voting for President Trump. He said he wouldn't vote for Biden either, but he wanted to keep his personal choices private. It turns out that there are 44 people who served in cabinet posts who served with President Trump and his cabinet. How many of those 44 have so far endorsed him? And the news from the Middle East indicates that there is some progress being made, getting some emergency supplies to beleaguered Palestinian civilians in the southern part of the Gaza Strip. But what about the back and forth between Senator Schumer, who was supported by President Biden? At least President Biden said Schumer made a good speech, and the Prime Minister of Israel, Bibi Netanyahu, who has responded not happily by the demand for new elections, which is one of the last things that Israel needs right now. They do need a new government, but to have elections in the midst of a war before that war has been firmly and decisively decided, that is, well, it's a very controversial idea. We will get to that. Speaking with Michael Rubin of American Enterprise Institute coming up on the Michael Medved Show. We'll also be speaking about the possibilities for all kinds of crazy third-party candidates. There is a billionaire, famous billionaire, from one of the most famous American financial families in our history, the Mellon family. Andrew Mellon was Secretary of the Treasury and a great Secretary of the Treasury, also founder of the museum, the National Gallery in Washington, D.C. A remarkable guy altogether. But one of his descendants has now committed to jointly fund President Trump and Robert Kennedy. What? Yeah, it's a strange world out there. Speaking of a strange world out there, I promise to tell you, and this is just one of those things that I would love for people to try to explain how people in the Trump camp would explain the fact that there are 44 different people who served in Trump's cabinet. And there were a lot of cabinet offices where people bounced around, where you didn't serve for a long time. John Kelly, for instance, started off as the Secretary of Homeland Security, and then he became the White House Chief of Staff, and then he had a big falling out with the president. In any event, of the 44 people who had been named to cabinet posts by President Trump, he's gotten the endorsement of four of them. Okay, can we try to grasp what we're talking about here? 90% of the people who served with him at the highest levels of government, people who were appointed by Trump, 90% of them have declined to offer their support for his return trip to the White House, which probably means they won't be making a return trip to the White House. This is all extraordinary. And part of what is so worrisome about the bloodbath to the country, if we can play that for just a moment, Jeremy, this is President Trump speaking in a particularly free form, how do we, let's use it that way, speech that went on and on and on and on. But one of the highlights of the speech that generated the most controversy was this, clip five.
4% of the automobile manufacturing business in our country, think of it, went to Mexico. China now is building a couple of massive plants where they're going to build the cars in Mexico and think that they're going to sell those cars into the United States with no tax at the border. Let me tell you something to China. If you're listening, President Xi, and you and I are friends, but he understands the way I deal, those big monster car manufacturing plants that you're building in Mexico right now, and you think you're going to get that, you're going to not hire Americans, and you're going to sell the cars to us now, we're going to put a 100% tariff on every single car that comes across the line, and you're not going to be able to sell those cars. If I get elected, now, if I don't get elected, it's going to be a bloodbath for the whole, that's going to be the least of it. It's going to be a bloodbath for the country. That'll be the least of it. But they're not going to sell those cars. They're building massive factories.
Okay. It's going to be a bloodbath for the country? And what he's saying is he's only talking about the problem of automobiles and the automobile industry. This is the idea of the word bloodbath even being in the air. There's a piece by Lance Morrow, who's one of my favorite writers. I don't know him, but he writes for the Wall Street Journal primarily. He is with the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, which is one of my favorite conservative organizations in the nation's capital. And he writes a piece that asks the question, will political hatred spill into the streets? And he recalls, there's something that I also recall because I was there briefly, was the convention in Chicago in 1968, where there were literally hundreds of people who were hospitalized. There were riots in the street. There were battles between police and demonstrators. And a lot of the demonstrators, as Lance Morrow points out, had come there with football helmets to try to protect themselves from being having brain damage, being beaten on the heads by the police officers in Chicago. And then the demonstrators were a motley crew, the Youth International Party. And after all, they were attacking the Democratic Convention. What all of this brings up is that with everything that we have going on in the country right now, what do you think the chances are that the Democratic Convention will be disrupted again, just as it was in 1968. Oh, and by the way, where's the Democratic Convention this year? It's in Chicago. So the idea of a repeat, and it's a little bit tougher to get that kind of crowd in Milwaukee, which is where the Republicans are having our convention. But for goodness sake, with this craziness of some of the demonstrations about the Middle East in particular, and with the great likelihood that by the time of the conventions in August of this year, July and August, that they may still be fighting in Gaza to try to decisively and definitively destroy the capacity of Hamas to make more trouble and do more mass killing, this could be a very real problem for the country. Because obviously one of the factors that led to the election of Richard Nixon was his convention, which was in Miami in 1968, which nominated Nixon for president, was far enough away from the radicalism on the streets of Chicago. We will be speaking with Michael Rubin of American Enterprise Institute about what exactly is going on with the ongoing war in Gaza and more coming up on The Medved Show. On the Michael Medved Show, pleased to welcome back to the show Dr. Michael Rubin, who is a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and director there of policy analysis. He specializes in Iran, Turkey, Russia, the broader Middle East. He's a former Pentagon official who has lived in post-revolution Iran. First of all, Michael, the excitement is over, I guess. I mean, pretty thrilling and close race in the Russian presidential election, huh?
Well, absolutely. And because they didn't allow international monitors, it's the most opaque election since the Soviet Union to hold them. But actually, what's kind of interesting here, and it just goes to show you what Putin's ego is like, at the end of this term, he will be the longest serving Russian leader since Catherine the Great, even more than Joseph Stalin.
But the kill ratio hasn't quite reach Stalinist levels yet.
But it might, because there's some reports that people were pouring paint in the ballot boxes in order to vandalize them.
And the official count, it shows that with about three quarters of the votes counted in this gigantic country, Putin has a solid lead of 87%.
And 13% of people have just disappeared.
But why does it make us laugh in this country that there is a major power in the world where there is an election that receives 87%? Do you believe that there is any chance at all to build a meaningful opposition party in Russia in honor of the late Alexei Navalny?
We'll put it this way. The opposition party is in prison, and people who emerge, Vladimir Karamirza, for example, if he survives, if we keep the limelight on him, will be the future of Russia. That said, for all of Boris Yeltsin's faults at the end of the 20th century, he was a drunkard, he wasn't the most efficient, he did lay the groundwork for a much more democratic system. Vladimir Putin has unraveled all of that. And so when Vladimir Putin dies, there's going to be a vacuum. There's going to be chaos because there's going to be no clear successor, no system to support him. That's what's dangerous. If I may, we joke about Russia, where 90% of the people vote for Vladimir Putin. But at the same time, Russia at least goes through this pantomime of elections. Think of the poor Palestinians, where Mahmoud Abbas, the chairman of the Palestinian Authority, is now in the 20th year of his four-year presidential term. They're such a dictatorship, they don't even bother holding elections anymore, and we give them a free pass.
Well, we give them a free pass, don't we? Because we know that if the elections were held in the Palestinian Authority, the elections would be won by Hamas, as they were the last time 20 years ago.
Well, that's not so sure. And put it this way, Hamas I don't see as a legitimate political party. They shouldn't be allowed to participate because if you're a political party but you also hold a militia, then you're not really a Democrat. I don't care what voters say at the ballot box, you're going to impose your force of will through the gun. And so parties like that, Hezbollah, Hamas, shouldn't be participants. That said, now that Hamas isn't and brought ruin, if we'd stop bailing them out, people might have a willingness to say something else about who they are and what they bring.
Okay, speaking of that, it looks like Chuck Schumer's now famous speech demanding a new election in Israel has had the opposite impact of what Schumer would have wanted. It seems to have strengthened Netanyahu by allowing him to say, we're not a banana republic, we're not going to be cowed, which most Israelis don't want somebody else determining when they have elections.
Well, you're absolutely right. But what I find even more ironic is look at the countries surrounding Israel, Jordan, Egypt. When have we lectured them on what they need a new election now? What about the Palestinian Authority just talked about? Chuck Schumer was way off base on this. You don't bash a democracy. And also, I don't think what Chuck Schumer doesn't understand is when it comes to security, there's not a left-right divide in the way there might be in the United States, because the issues for Israelis are real. When Hamas was raping, kidnapping, and murdering, they didn't ask people what their political affiliation was first.
What do you think is going to be the result? Is Israel going to cooperate getting some of these supplies, relief supplies, that now looks like they are? And are they going to proceed with what they say will be the conclusive phase of the war to knock out the surviving Hamas battalions near Rafah?
I think Israel will. Look, it's a matter of survival for them. And if they allow Hamas to survive, then they essentially allow Hamas to rebuild and they set the cycle down on repeat. But you know what hasn't really come out, but a brilliant international lawyer, Liz Sampson at the Henry Jackson Society, has pointed out, when it comes to this pier, this plan to have emergency relief come through a pier, the U.S. Navy ships are U.S. government territory. And the pier, if it extends from the ship, is also, if we construct it, it's U.S. territory. Now, what happens if the residents of the Gaza Strip decide to rush the pier and seek asylum, or rush the pier and say, you need to evacuate us from Gaza Strip? I'm afraid, for the sake of virtue signaling during the State of the Union address, Joe Biden has opened up a Pandora's box, and he doesn't understand where this could lead.
When are they supposed to have these piers or pier singular operational?
That's the big question, because from the reports I've seen, the people in charge of this, those who are going to construct it, deployed from Newport News, Virginia. The plans aren't in place. They were caught by surprise. They're on an indefinite deployment. And they're hoping that the Pentagon and the White House have a plan in place by the time they get to the Eastern Mediterranean a few days from now. But ultimately, we've done this once before in Haiti. It turned out to be a disaster. Actually, we've also done this in Honduras after Hurricane Mitch in 1999. But in Haiti and Honduras, you didn't have an active war going on, and you didn't have a U.S.-designated terror group on the other side of the pier.
So the prospect of continued hard times in Gaza continues, obviously. Michael Rubin, his most recent piece, which is a very important and stirring piece, is called Ukraine is the Front Line for Religious Freedom. And it says, as Ukraine's defense falters amid wavering commitment in Washington, the country's defenders depict its fight as a frontline defense for the rules-based order. And that is entirely true, but there's also the issue of religious liberty. Explain why that's so important in a few moments.
Well, I mean, basically, what people need to understand is when the Russians occupy Ukrainian cities, they're destroying all but the Russian Orthodox Church, or its Ukrainian equivalent. They're going after mosques. They're going after churches. It really is another tactic of what Russia is doing. And so if you're trying to bash Ukraine by saying just liberty, you've got it completely backward to what's going on. This isn't just about democracy. This isn't just about military strength and great power relations. This really is about religious freedom at this point.
Yes, and despite the words of Pope Francis calling for a white flag in Ukraine, it's very much Catholic churches that are also vulnerable and targeted. Read the piece. It's posted at michaelmedved.com. Michael Rubin, I know you have to run. Keep your eye on all of the dangerous places in the world. But is one of them really the U.S. with a bloodbath on our horizon? We will get to that. And on the Michael Medved Show, there is a hotly contested primary tomorrow. And this one, not like the Russian election where the outcome is known beforehand. And again, this means that Vladimir Putin is now elected with 87% of the vote. And he will continue to serve as Russia's president until 2030. In other words, I mean, even if Trump is reelected or if Biden is elected, they're done. They serve from 25 to the end of 2030, but they wouldn't even have a new election scheduled as we would in the United States. We'd go from 2024 to 2028. And it's all extraordinary. And meanwhile, we've had a lot of requests and a lot of reaction to a conversation we had on the air. And we now have that conversation available on our Substack account. Go to michaelmedved.substack.com. It's this conversation with four-star Admiral James Stavridis, who has been a supreme head of NATO in the past, and Elliot Ackerman, who is a Marine Corps veteran with five tours of duty in Afghanistan and Iraq. And they together wrote a novel called 2054, which is about something of the collapse of the world order, leading to a world at war. And it's believable, it's plausible, and it's thrilling. But you can check that out at michaelmedved.substack.com and hear what they have to say, not about just the world of speculative fiction, but the world of today's challenges. The primary tomorrow is in the state of Ohio. And Ohio is clearly a Republican state, but it has a very liberal Democratic senior senator. His name is Sherrod Brown. He's been there forever. And this looked like it was going to be the year when Republicans were going to beat him. They now have a polling that shows that there is a three-way race for the Republican nomination, and the top two finishers are incredibly close, and this the day before the primary. President Trump has jumped in to support a car dealer named Bernie Moreno. And there is also the candidate who's in the lead is a candidate named Matt Dolan. He led with 26%, followed by Moreno at 23%, and then the state secretary of state, LaRose, at 16%. The incredible thing is all three of the Republicans right now in trial heats, according to an Emerson College poll, all three of those Republicans would lose to Sherrod Brown. But with Dolan, it's incredibly close. With Dolan, Senator Sherrod Brown, the Democrat, would get 37% with 34% for Dolan, as opposed to Moreno, his main competitor, it would be a 5% spread. President Trump has supported Moreno, and partially because of differences on issues like Ukraine. And we were talking before about Trump's comments about a bloodbath in the United States if he isn't reelected, which does sound like a threat of violence, doesn't it? I mean, yes, he was talking about a bloodbath economically. That's what he has said in apology or explanation for his comments. But the historian Michael Beschloss, who is a historian in the American presidency, talked about the use of the term bloodbath on MSNBC. Listen, this is clip four.
In a way, Donald Trump has done us all a favor, because if you and I had been talking, Mika, let's say 20 years ago, and we had been talking about what would have seemed like a very abstract and distant subject of how fascism and dictatorship might come to America, you probably would have been more wiser. I would have said you would have had some smiling person pretending to be a normal candidate, like all the candidates for president who had gone before, all the way back to 1789. And suddenly, after getting elected, that person would use the enormous powers of the presidency that are given to that person by the Constitution. In a way, Donald Trump has made it easier, because when he tells you he'll be a dictator for a day, we all know that dictators don't resign after a day. When he uses the word bloodbath, yes, it was in the context of an automobile industry speech, but he knew exactly what he was saying.
Okay, the column I mentioned by Lance Morrow, Will Political Hatred Spill Into the Streets? He concludes the column this way. He says, this year, and it's only March, the idiom of hatred, especially the invective directed at Mr. Trump, and the equal and opposite invective fired back, has advanced to the brink of violence. The George Floyd summer, I'm afraid, was a foretaste of things to come. The comparison of Mr. Trump to Hitler, the 20th century's ne plus ultra of evil, has become a cliché. There they go again, a once mighty insult grown familiar and exhausted by overuse, tends to lose its power with the general public, if not with the accuser. When language becomes impotent, people reach for their clubs. maybe things will work out. But it's the Weimar comparison. The Weimar Republic is what preceded Hitler in Germany. But it's the Weimar comparison, not the Hitler part, but the general disintegration that comes back with an ugly pertinence. German political dialogue took to the streets, and the world became infinitely worse. That kind of concern that we face is also highlighted with this new Civil War film. There's a review in Variety where you want to, Alex Garland, the director, at least according to Variety, which has seen the film. I have not seen it yet, but it stars Kirsten Dunst, so it'll get some attention. But it'll get attention because of its subject matter. Do we really need this new film right now? It is a film counting on a divided audience to prevent his worst-cased horror show. They're talking about the director, Alex Garland. And a terrific Kirsten Dunst plays a jaded photojournalist documenting the end of democracy as we know it in what's sure to be one of the year's most controversial films. Well, controversial isn't always bad, but then again, if people want to learn about some of the issues underlying politics, which sometimes is a conflict of good and evil, there's a very different film out, which is called One Life, with Sir Anthony Hopkins. And yes, it's about Britain right on the eve of World War II and efforts to rescue children from Hitler's inferno. And there's also that remarkable series, which is about the Lincoln assassination and the aftermath. And the movie is Manhunt is the name of the series. And the third series just came out on Apple. And every one of the three episodes so far has been highly watchable and historically responsible. This is what some of the movie sounds like. Oh, okay. We will get to that later in the show. Coming up, we're going to be speaking to Aaron Dougherty of Axios, who is going to be bringing us up to date on a little bit of the most recent developments concerning no labels, because this could have a very profound impact on the ongoing presidential campaign. One of the things no labels could do is to blow up Robert Kennedy's campaign. Why? Well, because right now people are looking at Kennedy, especially with his talk of a new running mate who isn't Aaron Rodgers or Jesse Ventura. The idea of a third party, another alternative that isn't Trump and isn't Biden, worth pursuing in this greatest nation on God's green earth.